Now, on to this session, our final concluding session on what can we learn from World War I to make the 21st century a century of peace. This is an expanded session within our conference. It's a public forum, and we've invited participants from various places who have been involved in the Ottawa Peace Festival to join us. And I see a number of friends here today, so thank you and for coming and welcome to this final session. To moderate it, I would like to introduce our moderator sitting quietly behind me. For those of you who are most of you in the room, you will know this, but I want to say for our international visitors that one of the treasures we have in this country is the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, particularly CBC Radio. May it continue to shine, and we all know what that means. One of the stars central to the success and importance of CBC to most Canadians is our moderator, Michael Enright, who has been for more years than he's probably willing to count, a tremendous contributor to public discourse on any number of important issues, domestic, international, to cultural review of our country in the context of the global environment, and occasionally some comic relief that he's brought to us from time to time. He's currently anchoring Sunday Edition on Sunday morning, which takes up far more time than it should do for most of us, diverting us from sunshine sometimes, but we stick with it and thoroughly enjoy it. So to moderate our panel and conduct our final dialogue for this conference, I'm delighted to turn the mic over to Michael Enright.
Thank you. It's I'm very delighted to have been invited here. It's a delight to be here. As an amateur ironist, I love the idea of talking about peace in the War Museum. This has been a remarkable conference, I think, bringing together, as it has, experts in military affairs and diplomacy, political history, public policy. We've looked through the day at strategies and tactics of various armies, the function of propaganda, the impact on civilian society in combatant countries, and efforts to stop war from happening again. As someone who had six uncles fight in that war, I am supremely interested in it. None of them came back wholly integrated personalities. Two of them were gassed at Ypres. One was with the War Crimes Commission. His job was to go around and pick up the bits. None of them talked to me about... I only knew them as old men. And none of them talked to me about their experiences. The last surviving uncle died at age 94. And before he died, I asked him about 1418, and he said, terrible. And then he didn't say anything more again. Our panel here this afternoon has perhaps the toughest subject to explore of all. That is, what we have learned from the war. What we have learned militarily, politically, culturally, most importantly, what we've learned about ourselves. And how we can apply that knowledge to making our century one of world peace. I don't know if you saw the Globe and Mail this morning talking about the new world order, dripping in blood at the bottom there. I have to wonder if it indeed is a new world order as outlined by Woodrow Wilson, or if it's old wine in new bottles. And we will learn about that from our distinguished panel this afternoon. So I want to introduce them to you. Mustafa Asakal is from my right. Mustafa Asakal is a historian. He's associate professor at Georgetown University. He teaches courses in Ottoman and modern Turkish history. He's the author of The Ottoman Road to War in 1914, which is a comprehensive study in the internal reasons for the empire joining the war as Germany's ally. He has held a number of fellowships from the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Institute of Advanced Study at Princeton, and the American Council on Learned Societies. His current project is a study of military and civilian life during the war. Next to him, well-known Ernie Regeer. He's a senior fellow in Arctic Security for the Simons Foundation. He's also a research fellow at the Institute of Peace and Conflict at Konrad Grebel University College, University of Waterloo. He is, as you know, a co-founder of Project Plowshares. Mr. Regeer has been working in the cause of peace and arms control for most of his life. He's been an expert advisor to the Government of Canada delegations to multinational disarmament forums. He's a former member of the World Council Church's Commission on International Affairs and a member of the Order of Canada. Then Darrell Copeland. He is a senior fellow at the Canadian Defense and Foreign Affairs Institute. He's an analyst, an author, educator, consultant. He specializes in the relationship between science, technology, diplomacy, and international policy. He's been widely published in academic and other journals and anthologies. A former Canadian diplomat, Mr. Copeland has served in Thailand, Ethiopia, New Zealand, and Malaysia. He teaches courses at a number of universities, including the University of Ottawa. And next to him, Dr. Tamara Scheer. She's a lecturer at the Institute for Contemporary History at the University of Vienna. Since January 2010, she has been senior assistant at the Faculty for Central European Studies at Andrássy University in Budapest. And rounding out our panel, Professor Holger Afflerbach. He's professor of Central European History at the University of Leeds. He's the winner of many academic and other awards. Dr. Afflerbach is the author of 3 books and more than 30 scholarly contributions to journals and other publications. His research interests are as wide as they are varied: history of Europe in both world wars, international relations in Europe between Bismarck and 1914, and a history of war in the 19th and 20th century. That's your panel tonight. I want to start off with a simple-minded question for each of you to answer in your own way. Why is it important in our day to examine a war, a world war of 100 years ago? And I want to start with Dr. Scheer, Tamara. Why should we care? Why should we study it?
Well, as I said already in the morning, I'm just a historian. Micro doesn't work? Okay.
Put it close.
Can you hear me now? No? Yes?
Okay. Just tilt the mic. That's it.
Okay, perfect. As I already claimed in the morning, I'm just a historian, but why I started studying the First World War, well, I was always interested in topics which are under-researched, and from the University of Vienna perspective and from the Austrian historiography, it was fascinating for me why no one did research about the end of this Habsburg Empire. So most of the time, if you're looking on Austrian history, we are discussing 99% Sissi and her relationship with Andrássy, which we do not really know if that really happened, and how Hungary became more rights. And I was always fascinated by this world war where everyone said and claimed, well, it was inevitable that this will happen and this empire will fall apart. On the other hand, I asked myself, well, but it worked for centuries and it worked for decades, even in this so-called age of nationalism.
Dr. Afflerbach, why should we study the causes, the content, the implications of the First World War?
Yeah, so basically, okay, perfect. The First World War, in my eyes, is a cultural and political watershed with numerous implications until today. And that makes it worthwhile studying it, because the question of this panel is, if I quote here the program, what can we learn from World War I to make the 21st century a century of peace? If we take this question, we could also say, what did we learn from World War I to make the future a safer place? So what did we learn from World War I onwards until our days? Because it is not that a world war in which 9 million soldiers died stayed without consequences. And these consequences are not only on the level of Wilson, a new order, a League of Nations, but I'm speaking about a new culture. And I will make only one example to highlight that. Probably all of you know Horaz, dulcet decorum est pro patria mori, right? It is sweet and honorful to die for your fatherland. This was taught in European schools in the 19th century, and it was taken seriously. Today, this is a point which the American author Paul Fussell underlined very strongly. You cannot use Horaz, dulcet decorum est pro patria mori, without being or cynical or ironic. You cannot say that seriously, because otherwise they will send you to a madhouse. Try. Even in front of soldiers, try them to tell it is sweet and honorful to die for your fatherland. They will say you are out of your mind. And this is one of the political consequences and cultural consequences of the First World War. I would say that the traditional approach of European culture, the Greek-Roman tradition of regarding patriotism and the duties towards the fatherland, which was extremely strong in 1914, was completely transformed by the First World War. Now I could say that there is, of course, also the Second World War and the experiences, which again gave it another twist, but the enormous cultural watershed of the First World War, it's enormous, and it may be that in 200 or 300 years from now, we will see that the First World War was maybe a decisive turning point of European and world civilization.
Daryl Copeland.
Thank you, Michael. I think that we have to study World War I because it serves as an exercise in the failure of our ability to accommodate shifting power. If we can't improve our performance in somehow using the tools of nonviolent international political communication to accommodate power which is shifting upwards, outwards, and downwards at the same time, which is where we are now, in the same way as we failed to accommodate shifting power in the early part of the 20th century with Germany and Russia coming on strong, the mid part of the 20th century with Germany and Japan coming on strong, the Cold War, then we're in deep trouble. So I think that World War I, in fact, points in important ways to some things that we really better take on board. And let me.
For example,
disaster ensues when policy becomes an instrument of war rather than vice versa. That's a quote from Hugh Strawn. He's in the background paper. I think it's one of his more powerful insights. Another one from one of my favorite British authors and journalist, Robert Fisk, is that based on his study of the 20th century, the only thing we ever learn is that we never learn.
Ernie Regeer.
I'll preface it with reference to Professor Achenbach's reference to the dulcet decorum. The Wilfred Owen's poem, of course, is a terrific elaboration, or helps us understand the way to think about that that phrase. The importance of studying World War I, I think, has been stated, and the importance of commemorating the centenary of World War I, I think, is a little different. It's to look at the lessons, but I think it's also to remind us of the contemporary wars. A war 100 years ago, but we're in a world of very, very different kinds of wars, and I think that we need to look to some guidance to those wars for understanding the way in which we're going to prevent current wars, reduce the frequency of wars, and the dangers of getting engaged in them. There are, as I said earlier, you know, there's about 25 countries that are engaged in the level of violence that you can define as warfare.
But as has been said all day today, pardon me, World War I was a war between nation states.
Yeah.
What we have now are marauding bands of groups, of sectarian groups or non-religious groups. There are no frontiers, there are no fronts. Mm. How what has World War I got to teach us about that?
I'll just finish. Yes. I mean, my point is that I'm with you there. The level of learning available from World War I to inform us in policy responses to current wars may be limited, which is why I think we need to take the occasion of the centenary to shift the focus somewhat towards contemporary wars, to understand them better, to understand the nature of state failure that is really behind most of those wars, and to look at them with some care.
Right. Professor Escal.
Michael, you said World War I was a war between nation states, but really it's at the same time a war between empires. Mm-hmm. And thinking about the First World War is particularly salient, I think, in the case of the Middle East, because the First World War in the Middle East was a turning point, was transformative, and thinking about the changes, the consequences of that war, and thinking about the period before the war is instructive, I think, with great relevance to today. It broadens our imagination in seeing ethnic, religious, and sectarian differences at a time when these are not violent. But the First World War, in a way, touched off a civil war in the region, and produced traumas that had a long-lasting impact on the region in the 20th century. And I think a second reason, perhaps, why it's important to study the First World War and the way that war was settled in the Middle East, is to understand how that region got its current shape and why it hasn't worked. I'm not at all nostalgic for the Ottoman Empire, aside from the fact that is impossible to bring it back. But the Ottoman Empire was not replaced with something in the Middle East that was as durable and stable and that was able to govern such a diverse population. And so understanding this period, understanding the origins of so many of the instabilities of the Middle East today, I think, is very important.
Is there any point to assigning responsibility for the war, the outcome of the war? Do we learn anything from that we could put into practice? Anybody? Yes, Tamara.
Yes, well, I wouldn't say that there is the big difference that nowadays conflicts are so complex and hard to understand who are responsible, who are the actors, who is really working in the back and shaping the politics, and that it was not like that during the First World War, because it was almost the same. And I would point on this fabulous book written by Christopher Clark, and I really enjoyed how he's dealing with all of these countries waging the First World War by saying, well, you never knew which group of a state became active and influential the next day. And so they didn't know that from each other. And sometimes it was the press, and sometimes the king did that, what he thought the press would prefer, or the public opinion. Who is the public opinion? And I would say it's so similar. So if you're a historian, you always think of, oh, come on, read the newspapers from the 19th century or during the First World War. It's not that different.
But we live in an ahistorical period, though, really, politically, because the Americans learned nothing from Vietnam and blundered into Iraq. There was a poll recently taken in Germany that said that only 19% of the population thought that Germany was primarily responsible for World War One. Sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I guess the point I'm getting at is there any reason to assign blame, and can we learn anything from such assignment, or is it simply a waste of time, matter of...
I think, Michael, if I could just jump in, it's about trying to abstract useful observations from these things. And if we look at the way what might have been a relatively minor political occurrence, the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand in Sarajevo, spun terribly out of control and plunged much of the world into an incredibly damaging and long war. So what do we abstract from that? Well, one is when politicians default on their responsibilities for political decision-making and tend to hand the reins of control over to the generals and admirals whose job it is to make wars, you can find yourselves in terrible trouble. When your commitment to dialogue, negotiation, compromise, knowledge-based problem-solving, sit down, let's talk, when you let go of that in favor of, again, this default position that somehow you might be able to resolve your differences through the threat or use of armed force, then you find that you're in a situation which can't be managed, which can easily spin terribly out of control. So that I would suggest, rather than trying to point fingers and assign blame, might be one of these higher level observations that we could abstract from the World War I experience. But there are others.
Dr. Offerbach?
So basically, I think the very big success of Christopher Clark's book in Germany has indeed something to do with Christopher Clark's convincing attempt to spread the blame equally all over all participants, so that at the end Germany is looking exactly the same like the others. This is something which was really very benefiting for the German soul, and for that reason they finally they are not anymore blamed as the main culprit is something we see. As always, history has also something to do with actual politics, and there is probably a changed understanding of German importance in Germany from the Cold War until today. But this would now be a very long discourse leading us away from our topic, the First World War. And I wanted to make two quick points. The first one, learning of the First World War, something probably most of you will know, this quotation by President Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis, when he pointed towards Barbara Tuchman's Guns of August. So basically saying, don't let us do the same thing again. This is the first, we'll say, practical learning. Don't start it. And the second thing, on a symbolical level, I don't know if you are familiar with these meetings between François Mitterrand and Helmut Kohl on the battlefield of Verdun. You see the small Mitterrand and the gigantic Kohl hand in hand, and you see them from the back. It's a kind of iconic picture, and it means Don't let us make that again, that our nations have to make war and that we have again this kind of enormous graveyard, like Verdun is a gigantic graveyard now. And let us think about that and let's be friends in the European Union. I would say this is a definite historical lesson taught by the First World War. Verdun is a battlefield of the First World War and not of the Second World War, and which shows you that this has still an actual importance.
What also came into my mind is when I read the newspapers from about turn of the century, 1900 till 1914, was that my lesson learned was we should never lose interest or forget a conflict, even if it's small and seems to be limited. Because when I'm thinking of the Habsburg Empire and the newspapers reports, and in Habsburg Empire you had a lot of crises before 1914, and each crisis was followed by a severe discussion, well, this will end in the end of the empire, this will end in a big European war, and nothing happened. But it was expected all of the time. It was expected until the annexation crisis in 1909 during the Balkan Wars. And then there was this summer 1914. No one expected that. Everyone went to its summer vacations, and I had the feeling, huh? No one expected a big war, and then it was there.
In one of his letters, Bertrand Russell wrote that he was walking through Hyde Park on the day that war was declared by Britain, and people were celebrating. They loved the idea of it, to get back into the thing. I want to ask Daryl, Copeland is an expert on technology. The First World War gave us new killing technology, the Maxim gun, the tank, replacing cavalry and so on. What we learned, I will insist, from that is how to build better, deadlier weapons and nothing more. We didn't learn anything more about disarmament or anything.
No, I think what we should have learned was that as a result of using the principles of industrial process, and applying them to the art and science of warfare, that you end up with something which is so lethal and costly that you really shouldn't do it anymore. And that's what everybody said in 1919, and that's why they had the Versailles Conference and tried with the League of Nations and didn't learn that lesson and went through World War II, ramped it up even further, introducing the atomic bomb. And I guess that brought us to the stage where people considered that world war was perhaps something that could be avoided and should be avoided. But it strikes me, apropos to your point about technology, and going back to World War One, I mean, numbers are hard to come by, but something like combined civilian and military casualties in that conflict were around the 20 million mark. 1914 to 1918. 1918 to 1920, about something like 50 million people perished as a result of the Spanish flu. So what that says to me is that we really must prepare for non-traditional threats to our security, and this has big implications for the 21st century. And this is the one that's really flying under the radar, because if you look around right now, I mean, at the threats and challenges that really imperil the planet, it's not what we're seeing on the front pages every day. It's diminishing biodiversity, climate change, genomics, food and water insecurity, the challenges of managing the global commons. I mean, these are the things that can take down the planet, and which we're woefully unprepared to deal with.
But the World War One didn't speak to any of those. We didn't.
No, but that was the lesson. I mean, what I'm saying is, with 50 million people being taken out by the Spanish flu versus 20 million through conventional conflict, the lesson that we missed there is to keep our eye on the non-traditional threats to security.
I get the sensation that in talking about the First World War, we equate peace with victory, that there are legions of winners and legions of losers, and we're on the right, on the good guy side, and they're over there on the bad guy side. Does that distinction, that dichotomy still exists, does it not? And how does that help us reach some kind of understanding about doing away with war. Ernie, let me ask you that.
Well, our conference has been about World War I, but with a particular eye to the contemporary era and to current wars. One point about the technology. I saw a fair bit of the war in Sudan, and it rarely reached the level of technology of World War I. I mean, it was fought with a very elementary level of technology. Secondly, the issues about winning and losing really do not enter into it. I mean, most contemporary wars are fought over long periods of time, not until somebody wins, until both sides decide that what's going to happen on the battlefield is likely worse than anything that could possibly happen at a negotiating table.
Well, it's harder to recognize victory when we see it.
Yeah, and there isn't. I mean, the victory comes 10 years after the end of the fighting. If we're lucky, if we're wise, and if we do the kind of post-conflict peace building that we talk a lot about.
Dr. Achelbach?
Two quick points. The first one, winners and losers. I think for the First World War, this is probably a less pressing question than for the Second World War, thanks to the political consequences of that. Because in the Western countries, like in Great Britain, the Second World War can be interpreted as a completely legitimate and necessary attempt to stop a monstrous dictatorship from getting world domination. In German eyes, and also in Japanese eyes, the Second World War is a complete failure of a militaristic concept, and for that reason, the natural consequence out of that is pacifism. Look towards Germany and Japan today. They are deeply pacifistic societies because of this interpretation of the Second World War, while in Great Britain you have this interpretation out of the Second World War. You have to step in if necessary to stop an evil monster to take over. This is a very different political approach, I think. The second point which I want to make, and again it has nothing to do with the first point, but still, is there are levels of comparison, or basically comparisons have to stop somewhere. And if I compare World War I with an illness, I would say that World War I is an extremely dangerous form of cancer, a deadly illness, because of its size. And then we have smaller wars, and we have seen Ernie's numbers there about the losses like Afghanistan and so on. And as dramatic as it is, in comparison with the First World War, it's a skin disease. And you cannot compare a skin disease with a dangerous form of cancer. It makes no sense. And I think something like Afghanistan has to be compared with colonial conflicts of the 19th century and not with the First World War.
I would say that in the case of the Ottoman Empire and the Turkish Republic, the distinction between winners and losers is winning and losing is highly ambiguous, because in a way the Ottoman Empire lost, but the Turkish Republic won. And so in the 1920s and 1930s, there was a sense in the new republic, under Mustafa Kemal Atatürk's republic, until 1938, that in fact the Turkish nation had been born and that there had been a victory. There had, of course, been a victory between 1919 and 1922 in that the Allied occupation of Istanbul was pushed back, Greek forces were defeated in Anatolia, a French Armenian small army was defeated in southeastern Anatolia. So there was a deep sense of victory, and Gallipoli, of course, that overshadowed and that, in a way, marginalized the defeat of the Ottoman Empire in 1918. But your earlier question, is it important? And is it important to study the First World War, and is it important to have responsible parties? I think maybe not responsibility, but to understand the origins of the war in the Turkish case is extremely important. Yesterday, John Zieber talked about it's about stories from the First World War and stories that we tell each other and that we teach students in school. In Turkey, this is extremely important to tell different stories about the First World War, because the stories about the First World War that are being told are very much being told through a nation-state filter, or through the prism of the nation-state. And that really served the purposes of the regimes that came after the war, but it covers up the lessons that we should take away from the First World War.
Dr. Shearer, and then Daryl Corker.
Just a short comment, and I hope it's okay if I raise the question, but we're talking about why war happened and who is responsible for what and what we can learn out of war, but what about thinking about it the other way around? Why, before 1914, we had a long period of peace, and why did this peace work?
That's a good point.
Well, a very good point, and I wanted to say a little bit about if we go back 100 years rather than forward 100 years from 1914. So 1814, we're right at the end of the Napoleonic Wars. We get the Congress of Vienna, then the Concert of Europe, and, you know, what lessons can we abstract from that? Well, one is that diplomacy can deliver results. It did. Almost 100 years of peace, except for the Franco-Prussian War in 1871 and a couple of revolutions around 1848. It was pretty peaceful as things go in Europe. Two is that power can be balanced. That was the first time anybody really tried it. I'm a bit skeptical about that concept, but they did seem to pull that off. They certainly tried hard. And the third thing is that human agency makes a difference. We had Metternich, Castlereagh, Talleyrand in there, and through the sheer force of their wills, they were able to cobble together this concert of years. So some very important lessons that managed to keep Europe largely in peace for 100 years. But that's just bouncing off her comment. What I wanted to say about winners and losers has to do with Rob Thompson's comments earlier today about framing. If you frame something as a war, then there's going to be winners and losers. And I think that this is part of our problem, is that our vocabulary, our minds, our media have become so militarized that we're really quite caught up in this idea. But let me say this in response. You know, you can't call in an airstrike on a warming climate. You can't garrison against pandemic disease. You can't send out an expeditionary force to occupy the alternatives to a carbon economy. All of which is just to say, there really are no military solutions to a lot of these very, very large issues. And as long as we keep thinking in terms of winning and losing and wars, and I'm quite beside myself at the moment because we're facing this double whammy of a resumption of some kind of war on terror and Cold War II at the same time, this is a very bad combination, and it's going to distract us and otherwise defeat our efforts to focus on these larger, more complex issues rooted in science, driven by technology, that are really much more worrisome in the long term, in my view.
ISIS has become the new Hitler, hasn't it? In a sense,
yes.
And that we must marshal all forces, President Obama said, whatever it takes to do it.
Degrade and destroy.
Yeah.
War
talk.
We're not talking about bringing to bear the supple instruments of statecraft here. we're really talking about banging, and banging is not going to get us where we need to be.
Is it possible, and even likely, that there is something in the human constitution that makes us incapable of learning from acts of mass violence? That there's something about war and violence, the ingrained elements of it in our personalities, that we really don't learn anything. I think what we learned from the First World War was how to run a more efficient Second World War.
No.
Let's argue the point. What do you think, Ernie Regeer?
Well, I think the
We need to credit ourselves with having learned a lot about preventing war.
Yeah, like what?
There are a lot of wars that have been prevented, and the level of warfare now is as Professor Offenbach was saying, the level of casualties within that war is just orders of magnitude different than it was 100 years ago.
All right, I interviewed Robert McNamara
right,
a number of years ago. It was a very tendentious interview, and I said, he was talking about his book, and I said, on every page you apologize for something. He said, no, not apologize, identify. He said, you have to remember that 48,000 people died in that war. And I said, Mr. Secretary, 48,000 Americans died in that war. Mm-hmm. 2.2 million Vietnamese. And he said, oh, well, if you count them. So tell me how that speaks to a learning process about a war.
Well, that's not the way to learn about a war. contemporary research and investigation of contemporary wars has uncovered and identified the conditions that are most likely to lead to war, and there are a lot of countries in which those conditions obtain, but in which war does not exist. And briefly, I mean, if you have conditions of severe grievance, and that's common to a lot of societies, that's political conflict. The likelihood of political conflict going into armed conflict increases dramatically if political grievances are clearly identified with an identity. Either they're regionally based, or you get to say that my grievance, my economic grievance, is mine because I'm a Serb rather than something else.
I'm Irish. I know about grievance.
Right, yeah. Right. So if it's identity located, then that increases. Then it comes the matter of capacity, and if you look and access to weapons, if you go to a place like the Horn of Africa, there's plenty of grievance. There's a lot of identity conflict in that area, and the place is swirling with light arms. So those are all conditions. But really, a very key factor is then a deep sense amongst the aggrieved or governments that there is absolutely no alternative. We have no other way of making our case. The total absence of politics and diplomacy in that context. And just sorry for going on, but just to complete that point, it's really that latter thing that is the most amenable to an emergency response. You can't change identity issues. That's right. Generational. Grievances are generational. But you can use diplomacy, and you can create forums and opportunities. That's what the British Army or the Egyptian Army, in a sense, did that in Egypt. And it's complicated what the outcome is, but I mean that was a very important element of preventing Egypt from going the direction that Libya and Syria went was by this sense that there was a constant presence of negotiation and talking. And that's the way in which the international community, I think, can intervene and contribute to part of a war prevention program.
Marsh here, and then Professor Oskar.
Yeah, well, I would also say if I look on the Habsburg Empire, I would say what we can learn is it's the same with each relationship. Never stop talking, and then yet never stop, having your transnational cooperation, even if there is a political crisis going on. Just go on talking.
Professor, and then Daryl Copeland, go ahead.
Well, just the observation that it seems more compelling and necessary than ever to understand these local conflicts and to prevent them for the very reasons that Daryl Copeland mentioned, right? If we're destroying the planet, and your question about do we ever learn from wars, do we keep fighting the human by studying history, I think one gets the impression that humans are a very self-destructive species. But it seems that understanding these conflicts is ever more important, so that the bigger questions can really be questions can really be answered and dealt with.
Derek?
Yeah, just a quick point on this, because I think there's a terribly important issue of public policy here. Keep talking, okay. Talk, don't fight, great. Dialogue, negotiation, compromise, multilateralism. If we all agree that this is an area in which we need to improve performance and enhance our capacity, then the question is, why are the lion's share of resources in Canada and everywhere still with defense departments, and not with aid agencies or diplomatic corps? I mean, this is a really fundamental question which never gets put. And the imbalance is such that it is grotesque. I mean, I suppose that the United States is probably the most extreme example, but one of the illustrations that Robert Gates used to always use, and he used it in a Landon lecture at the University of Kansas in 2007, just the three bullet points because they're so good. There are more soldiers in the uniform marching bands of the American Armed Services than there are diplomats in the State Department. There are more lawyers in the Pentagon arguing things like why torture is legal than there are diplomats in the State Department. And 1 year's worth of increase in the American Defense Department budget is greater than the total budget of the State Department, which includes all of the money that's spent by USAID and the United States Information Service every year. So that's what the militarization of international policy looks like, and it strikes me that one of the reasons that we are just so ineffective at broaching these highly complex issues is that we've got a real problem of resource allocation that hasn't been addressed.
And I think, can I make point about that? And that we do have some models where the resource allocation is a bit more sane. In the U.S., it's about 24-1 military to development assistance, just to take one measure. In Canada, it's about 4-1. In the Nordics, Denmark, Norway, it's virtually 1-1. So there are some among us who have learned to allocate the resources a little differently, and look what they do internationally. They're pretty effective, and there's a pretty big service of their national interest in the process.
One thing we did learn from the war, and that was the art, science, or practice of commemoration, we are surrounded by it in this building. Is there not a fine line between commemoration and
adulation?
Glorification. And doesn't that speak to the point of why we are so militaristically inclined, that we look back on, some of us look back on these days as days of glory? Derek, who wants to take that? Tamara?
I just want to pick up the discussion we already have. So I would say, examples from history. And if I think of the Habsburg Empire, I would say it's too easy to say, just do not give the money to the army, but give it to cultural associations, give it to aid organizations. Because when I think of the Habsburg Empire, well, according to Peter Jepson, who is a really famous and excellent Habsburg historian, well, he said that it had been these cultural organizations who were the nationalists and who prepared the public opinion for preparing them to be ready to go to war. And there had been a lot of followers among the Habsburg officers' corps of Bertha von Suttner. So I wouldn't... Also the Hungarian, for example, the Hungarian Red Cross had was very nationalistic. So it's not black and white, I would say. It's difficult.
I think in contemporary wars, that whole commemoration thing is going to be very, very different, and is for those that have recently ended wars. I mean, there are no marching bands sending off people to go to war in Syria or Libya when they first protested against Gaddafi and so forth. And if you go to post-war countries like Ethiopia, there isn't a celebration of the honor and heroism of war. It's far too close and immediate, and the consequences of 30 years of fighting is still far too visceral. I think maybe 100 years from now they'll look back and be meeting in a war museum and celebrating it, but I doubt it.
I want to bring our audience in. I just want to ask one final question, and for anybody or everybody. The Canadians and the British and the Turks and the Germans and everybody else who died in that war of the 20 million, did they all die in vain? Go ahead, Ben.
Depends on the point of view. Because if we see it from an individual point of view, of course they did died in vain, kind of. If we see it as a kind of watershed towards the progress of mankind, because this enormous sacrifices and the senselessness of the sacrifices prevents future wars, you can interpret a certain sense into that. Or you can say it is a completely senseless carnage. It depends very much on the point of view.
Darryl?
Nothing was achieved, little was learned, and I do think that those deaths were in vain. Why were the costs so high? It strikes me that the idea that we haven't managed to really wrap our heads around is that security, at the end of the day, is not a martial art, fundamentally. That human security comes from an absence of fear, an absence of want, having your basic needs met. What that means is that there's a real relationship between underdevelopment and insecurity. As long as there's gross underdevelopment, growing inequality, a lot of want and a lot of fear out there in the world, then there is going to be an absence of security and people tending to think that the answer somehow is the threat or use of armed force. And I think that it's that connection that has to be broken. That's a lesson that was unlearned as a result of World War I, World War II, the Cold War. Back to Robert Fisk again, is it really true that the only thing we ever learn is that we ever never learn? I desperately hope not. But the evidence to date is a bit discouraging.
Well, should we go to the audience now? There are two microphones, one there, one there. If anyone has a question, it's a very touchy, tricky subject, and I think I applaud you people. You've done a great job. Yes, ma'am, over there.
My name is Anne Young. I'm a member of a group of 78. I note that four of our five panelists are historians. So my question is, why is history not taught in Ontario high schools beyond grade 10, I believe? And I don't know what happens in the other provinces, and I don't know what other countries are doing.
Anyone? Is it taught? I don't. I can't. It was taught when I went to high school, but that was back in the Middle Ages. So
basically, this is probably different from country to country. And history in Germany is taught from the fifth class onwards.
Yeah.
In Austria from the second.
And also in the classes before, they have a kind of history, only that it is called differently.
I think in Europe there's a greater emphasis on history and the teaching of history than there is here.
Yeah.
Darryl Copeland, do you have any idea, or Ernie?
I don't know about Ontario. In Turkey, history is taught from the cradle up and all through grade schools. History is a very important tool in public education in shaping the kind of citizenship that.
The teaching in the United States has become so politicized now that university graduates can't find France on a map. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you made a good point. It's what history do we teach? That's an important question. One of the problems, I think, that comes out when we discuss the First World War, we can talk about the imperialistic countries and the empires and all that, but also it was a whole discourse of that went back right into the 19th century and maybe even earlier, of imperialism in the sense of we are right, we are going to build an empire. A good example of that is, and we're seeing that a bit with the present government as a throwback, this whole thing about finding Franklin's ships, okay? To me, Franklin was a British imperialist who wanted to get through the Arctic Ocean. He was stubborn. He almost died, his people, in his first expedition through the Northwest Territories, and they all died, whereas they were always close, reasonably close to the Inuit people. They never had anything to do with them. I mean, the more you read about Franklin, the more you see the absurdity of the whole thing. But then it's become a wet dream of our current Prime Minister of finding the ships. And it seems they have found one ship. But it's what's behind that. And that's not what's coming out, unfortunately. It's the same thing with the War of 1812-14. To us Canadians, there's something interesting there we can learn from our own history. And, be happy that we pushed the Americans back and all that kind of stuff. But once again, Harper and his gang turned it into pornography, which can be a beautiful story into something very ugly. So that goes right through today, and it was very predominant in the late 19th century. The Henty books, some of you guys have heard about them, this British heroic stuff. And that's very scary. I can't talk about the other countries. But the British thing, which influenced Canada, is one of the reasons why we went to war. So gloriously.
Do you want to frame a question for one of
our panelists? Yeah. It's the whole ideological stuff, the discourse, which to me is an important thing of distracting people from real problems. And you made a very important point about global warming, right? This is, you could do a beautiful thing between the Franklin stuff, Harper, and the Arctic. But the real problem. So how are we going to deal with these kind of things in today's context?
Ideology versus history. Daryl?
Yeah, tough. I mean, I think the only possible chance for really improving our performance and addressing this issue of problem with resource allocation, gross imbalance and so on, is by somehow finding a way to get this onto the political agenda. It's not really showing signs of breaking through at the moment, but even at the height of the Afghan war, I mean, we had two elections, and it didn't break the surface. So I guess, one wants to certainly keep trying, but until such time as these issues become politically salient domestically, it's difficult to imagine that we're going to do a better job.
Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Nolan. I'm one of the rapporteurs out of Conrad Grable. I'm a master's candidate.
You're not going to read a statement, are you?
Pardon?
You're not going to read a statement,
no,
are you?
No, I was just a brief introduction.
Okay. Briefly.
As an American, this question that I'm going to ask is going to touch close to home. America has not fought essentially a large-scale war since the early 1860s, the American Civil War. Could that absence of a war on home territory for that long be fueling the lust for war that our nation has? Because from personal experience, I see people who love the Second Amendment because they love the idea of having a gun because they can be a cowboy at any time. Because they're so far removed from war in a personal context, other than, soldiers coming home, is that a fuel for their lust for war?
That's a great question. Who would you like? Anyone?
Yes. Whoever.
Dr. Alfred.
I think it's quite easy to agree on that one, because if you are... if you have a natural culture and you have seen that after a completely lost war the enemy is standing in your capital, this is basically cooling down military enthusiasm considerably indeed.
And the last time that this happened with the United States of America was indeed in 1812, as you know.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question about empire. People have talked about the imperial origins of World War I. The subject of the conference is contemporary policy. How about today's particular imperial dispensation with an American empire that's arguably in the decline, rise of China? If people could talk about that, I think it would be quite interesting.
Professor Haskell? On empire?
Yeah, I mean, I think the world is very different now in terms of the international constellation of states. Is America pursuing its imperial interests in the Middle East? I think it would be fair to say yes, no question about that.
I think that the I think that the old imperial construct is of limited power in helping us explain and understand what's going on in the world today. I like Chrystia Freeland's ideas about plutocracy and the fact that there are a small group of super rich people in the world who think alike, act alike, share the same tastes, stay in the same hotels and so on, and then there's just about everybody else. States are of decreasing importance, I think, overall in the way things are shaking out in the 21st century. We're looking at whole new patterns of organizations and forms of the dispensation of power and influence that have less to do with anything that we're very familiar with. So I think we've really got to keep our eye on that ball. But the one thing that I want to say, and I don't want to unleash it right now, but I hope we'll get a chance. I think we should talk a bit about Canadian international policy and whether or not there are lessons from our discussions over the last few days and World War I per se with the various places and spaces that we're occupying in the world, because it strikes me as being here in the capital, it would be unfortunate if we didn't touch on that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Scheer.
But is it really new that we can say that states lose agency? Because when I think of how Serbia was shaped throughout the 19th century, it just started as an uprising or several uprisings, and the one side called it freedom fighters, and the other one, well, the Austrian bandits, the Ottomans, an uprising. So I would say it's nothing new what happens now. If you look on the Balkans in the 19th century.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. My name is John Curtis. I'm an economist, so I'm a little worried we haven't had much economics discussion over the last 24, 36 hours. But let me ask the panel one question. I think Daryl got close to it. In today's world, the private sector, be it the 1%, the half of 1%, the multinational corporation, which controls a lot of science, a lot of applied science, a lot of knowledge, what responsibilities do they have as we look ahead? It strikes me that Daryl Copeland has talked about the size of the Pentagon budget, for example, as against the State Department. If we realize that there's $18 trillion of financial assets moving around the world every single day, that makes the Pentagon budget very, very small. What's the responsibility of the private sector as we look ahead?
Mr. Copeland?
Yeah, it's the whole issue, I guess, John, of regulation and whether or not we're capable of keeping pace with changes in the distribution of power and influence. I opened with this idea that power is on the move. It never stays in one place, and right now it's moving very quickly. One of the places that it is moving to is out from the public sector into the private sector, and we are not prepared either institutionally or intellectually to grapple with that. And, if someone asked me to come up with a to-do list, I would put that issue, very, very near the top of the list. At the end of the day, though, again, if we don't find some way to bring elements of responsibility and accountability, so in other words, connect the interests of the polity or the citizenry or whatever you want to call it, with decisions that are taken in private, in the corporate world, if we can't find some way to mesh those two different clusters of interests, either through creating new institutions or finding a better way to approach the science of regulation or something, then it strikes me that this polarization, which has become really one of the defining elements of globalization, and by that I mean this tendency to privatize benefits while socializing costs, is just going to continue, and one wonders how much elasticity there is in that system before something snaps. And if something snaps at that level, the kinds of threats and challenges we've been talking about today might seem like kindergarten issues.
Yes, sir. Maybe two more questions. You have maybe two.
My name is Manfred Bienefeld. I'm vice chair of the group of 78 and a professor emeritus from Carleton. Just a very quick point to Holger Afterbach. The idea that dying for your fatherland is glorious is an archaic notion is fair enough, except I would suggest for the United States. I'm constantly astonished at the degree to which military service is extolled at the beginning of every sports event in that country. So it is not something that's disappeared. It is alive and well in some parts of the world. But more generally, what I think obviously, many of the presentations have been wonderful. I think in the end, I'd like to build on Derek Copeland's first comment, which is the thing we need to learn from World War I is how to manage a shift in global geopolitical power. And I think if we start with that concept, I have argued many years ago, decades ago, the height of the Cold War, I said something quite controversial. I said, if there ever is to be another world war, it will not come out of the Cold War. It will come when a major power, a major militarized power, has mismanaged its affairs to such a degree that life as it knows it has become virtually impossible. And I think we are drifting close to that situation. I think the instability of the global economy, and that comes back, the undermining of labor market situations in societies around the world. I've worked on development for most of my life. I now go around giving a lecture called The Death of the Dream of Development, because the thing that we dreamed about, which was that the developing countries would acquire the characteristics of development, meaning full employment, social stability, high levels of social service, political stability, genuine democracy, the idea that they would acquire those things has given way to a situation where those things are being eroded in what were once known as the developed countries, except in a few places like Scandinavia, which has been mentioned. So I think our focus needs to be to link together economic stability and the ability to maintain political stability.
Okay. Yes, last question, sir.
Yes, my name is Jerry Olson. I'm chair of a group called Afghanistan Pathways to Peace. Thank you very much, all of you. This has been a fascinating conversation. Daryl, you implicitly offered a challenge, which nobody actually took up, to say that we can't move the peace agenda forward until it becomes part of the political dialogue. This is a room very much filled with activists. Could the panel give their advice to this group of people, many of whom have been engaged one way or another in the peace movement or support for elements thereof throughout their lives? Could you give us your advice as to what we do, not just in Canada, but internationally, to get the agenda of building peace and sustaining peace on the global agenda? Thank you.
See, I should have asked that question.
That's a great question.
Go ahead. That's our last question, your last answers. What advice? And let's start at the other end of the table with Dr. Afterbach.
What advice, nothing less. So basically, what advice can a World War I historian, because this is basically the task of this panel, give to contemporary politicians or political activists? I would always say that history, differently from political science, does not try to create concepts for action. You know, political scientists always try to put things into boxes and then you can have a kind of lesson learned thing. History is highly individualistic and every case is different. And so this means that you see a highly specialized historical situation in 1914 and it is very difficult to get actual, you know, ways of action if you compare it with a situation like Ukraine. What can we learn in acting in Ukraine today in 2014 if we look back towards 1914? Then I can say probably the lessons are most banal and something which you can do very easily with a working brain without being a historian. For example, avoiding war with a great power or something like that.
Or well, that would be your advice.
God is always with the stronger battalions. It's not from me. Napoleon the First says this. Normally the stronger army wins, something like this.
All right.
And if you really look towards historical lessons, I would really go with Jakob Burckhardt, this famous Swiss historian who worked on the Renaissance, who said about the task of history, nicht klüger fürs nächste Mal, sondern weise für immer, and now I need some translation help. This is not try to learn this kind of lesson-learn approach, but being wise. Wise in the sense that you understand what can go wrong and that everything which goes wrong can theoretically go wrong, went wrong at some time in the past, and so be careful.
Tamara Shear, your advice, Tamara, briefly.
Well, just briefly, when I think of Bertha von Suttner, and I see her over there in the exhibition several times, when I came first across her was mainly in satirical newspapers where people were constantly making jokes about her and about her peace talks and peace plans and... But she never stopped talking about it, and she didn't give up. And still, 100 years later, we're talking about her and what she did. And I guess that's the most important thing. Even if they laugh about you and they say, come on, stop talking about peace all the time, don't stop.
Mr. Copeland.
I'm a passionate believer in Canada's capacity to play a constructive, innovative, and helpful role in the world, one which we unfortunately seem to have surrendered, and as a result of that, much has been lost. And it's not just the disappearing institutions like Rights and Democracy or the Pearson Peacekeeping Center. It's not just the defunding of important civil society organizations like the Canadian Council for International Cooperation or Kairos or the North-South Institute, but it is those things too. But it's our walking away from internationalism. It's the retreat from diplomatic initiative. You know, we never had great power, but we did have influence. We did have good offices, and we had ideas, and we used them. And we use them to good effect. The International Criminal Court, the Landmine Treaty, the small arms attempt at control, you know, child soldiers, there was lots. So what to do? Well, we certainly have to keep thinking globally, but in terms of acting locally, I think there's really only one way to address this, given the nature of Canadian politics in 2014. And that's to insist on proportional representation and coalition government.
All right. Okay, I want to move on. Your advice, Mr. Regeer, briefly.
Well, when we get that progressive government, and I agree with everything that Daryl just said, I think that there are really two agendas. One agenda is the kind of the policies and initiatives that are needed for building sustainable, peaceful societies. I mean, that deals with human security, with climate and environment, financial equity, all of those things that make a social order sustainable. A second related but distinct is war prevention, war avoidance, and that deals with crisis response capacity, diplomacy, certainly arms control, those kinds of measures. So I think we have a kind of dual agenda which we need to pursue.
Professor Askal Mustafa.
I would say it's crucial to think about the Middle East historically. When we think about the Middle East over the last two centuries, we see heavy Western involvement in the region for the past 200 years. And so that would mean that, and that involvement has not produced peace or stability or prosperity. So I would say that to understand that means that we don't see a region, that the situation we have in the Middle East today is a result of this heavy international involvement, and that there is a shared responsibility on the part of the West, that this is a product of the international system and of international rivalry. And so that we don't think about the region as inhabited by populations who are prone, who have a tendency toward war, and who are prone to violence, but that this, in fact, is a result of international interaction of the past two centuries.
Bravo. Thank you very much, panel. And I thank you for being here tonight. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Before we break, people, I'd just like to thank Michael Enright for trekking all the way from Toronto, responding to our call to assist us with this, and we're very, very grateful.